Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 4th of January. Day after the Iowa caucuses, in Citizens United, the Supreme Court struck down the decades-old federal ban on independent expenditures by corporations and unions to influence federal elections. As a result, in Iowa, we saw $9 million being spent independent expenditures on political ads and $4 million by the candidates. So just in the state of Iowa, $12.5 million were spent for these caucuses. This hour of the program, we'll be looking at the guide to the current rules for federal elections and the impact of Citizens United, in which the Supreme Court really changed election laws quite significantly in this country, and some of the challenges that are taking place to that in some states around the country. We'll have two guests with us during the course of the hour. We should learn a lot, and it should be very interesting. Paul S. Ryan joining us the first part of the program. He is Program Director and Associate Legal Counsel for the Campaign Legal Center, specializing in campaign finance, ethics, and election law for more than a decade, and is a former political Reform Project Director at the Center for Governmental Studies in Los Angeles. He directs the Campaign Legal Center's Federal Election Commission program and presents the Legal Center before the commission. He litigates campaign finance issues before federal and state courts throughout the United States and has published extensively on the subject of election law. Later this hour, Bradley Smith, professor of law at Capital University Law School, former chair of the Federal Election Commission. Our phone number for you to join this interesting conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Paul S. Ryan, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to join you.
Oh, how Iowa could have used $12.5 million for some other purposes, don't you think?
Indeed.
It is a lot of money. Tell me the significance and how we are seeing the impact of Citizens United, and we'll start with Iowa and then go to how you expect to see it in the general presidential election.
Well, the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United really needs to be best understood. It also needs to be discussed in the context of another court decision that came a couple of months later out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, a case called Speech Now. The two of them together are what have given us what we now know as super PACs, these groups that are out there raising and spending unlimited amounts of money to influence federal candidate elections. So in Citizens United, the Supreme Court said that corporations have the same First Amendment rights as human beings, as natural persons, to spend as much money as they care to on ads that expressly advocate a candidate's election or defeat, ads saying, vote for candidate X, vote for candidate Y, et cetera. And then, a couple months later, in the D.C. Circuit Court, the court said that because the Supreme Court said corporations have this First Amendment right to make unlimited independent expenditures, and the Supreme Court in Citizens United based its decision on the notion that independent expenditures can't corrupt candidates for public office, and that's why there's no government justification for limiting those expenditures. And the D.C. Circuit Court said in Speech Now that based on that rationale, groups that want to make such independent expenditures cannot be subject to contribution limits. Contribution limits as applied to independent expenditure groups are violate those groups' First Amendment rights. So this is what gave us the super PAC. I know in Iowa, I've been reading media reports that super PACs have, the super PAC supporting Mitt Romney, for example, spent twice as much as the Romney campaign itself. And this is a big problem, largely because the second really important part of the Citizens United decision was that, part one, corporations have a First Amendment right to make unlimited independent expenditures. Part two, the court assured America that we should not be troubled by this because we will have full and accurate and timely disclosure. The second piece of this disclosure, I have great doubts that we'll actually see effective disclosure because of these super PACs. What the super PACs allow is a money to be moved around from one group to another a couple of times to obscure the original source of the money, to hide the identity of the original source. So we're going to see record amounts of spending by outside groups and probably less disclosure, despite the Supreme Court's assurances, than we've ever had before in federal elections.
Tell me why you think this happened and how it changed, what the history here is. Did it change election law that had been in place for decades and decades?
Yeah, I mean, why it happened is pretty simple. The composition of the Supreme Court changed. It was the replacement of Justice O'Connor with Justice Alito that tipped the balance in the court. So one of the things they don't teach you in law school that I wish they had taught me in law school that is that the Constitution is what five members of the Supreme Court says it means. Mm-hmm. And back in 2003, there were five members, a five-justice majority on the court, including Justice O'Connor, who said that it is perfectly constitutionally permissible to prohibit corporate spending in federal elections. And we see in the 2010 Citizens United decision with a tilt in the court, replacement of Justice O'Connor with Justice Alito, with the court changing its opinion and saying that it is no longer constitutional to ban these expenditures by corporations. The corporations have been prohibited by federal law from contributing directly to candidates since the early 1900s, and they had been prohibited from making political expenditures since the 1940s. So this was a major, major shift in what really amounts to at least a century of campaign finance regulation, all made possible by the switch in the composition of the court.
And because disclosure is so murky, as you say, we have at this moment no idea who is in the super PAC for Mitt Romney or other candidates, but Romney had a huge one in Iowa.
Well, that's not quite the case. It is, in fact, the law that super PACs have to tell the Federal Election Commission where they're raising their money. But when we see these reports start to come in from the super PACs, what we'll likely see is that they've received contributions, huge contributions, six, seven-figure contributions from groups with innocuous-sounding names like Americans for America or Moms for Apple Pie. And it's the ability of corporate entities, in this case they're probably going to be nonprofit 501c4 corporations, to contribute to these super PACs, which, again, was only made possible in 2010 by the Citizens United decision combined with the later decision in Speech Now, that wealthy corporate interests are going to be able to launder their money legally, entirely legally, through intermediary organizations, through corporate entities that can pass it on in unlimited amounts. So I suspect that Brad Smith, who I've known for years and respect, I suspect he'll tell your listeners later in this hour, oh, don't worry, don't listen to Paul Ryan. Super PACs have to disclose everything they raise. Well, we'll see when they have to file their reports how useful that information is. I'm predicting it won't be particularly insightful for voters.
Mm-hmm. And what about the amount of money that will go into the presidential race? Will this Supreme Court decision make all these races much, much, much more expensive?
I think it will undoubtedly make the race is more expensive. It's difficult to quantify exactly how much more money we're going to see in the races. Those predictions are tough to make, but we'll definitely see more money. The biggest difference, though, is going to be that the money will be spent by outside groups. I think we're going to see a lot, and the Iowa caucuses are a great illustration of that. Again, reading the press accounts over the last day or so, that the super PAC spent twice as much as the candidates here. That's a pretty significant shift from prior election cycles. Combined with the lack of transparency and where this money is coming from being spent by the outside groups, that's really troubling to me.
And there is some kind of law that keeps the candidate from having some association with these super PACs, even though people who previously worked in their campaigns may now be with the super PACs?
Well, it's a great point. I've been reading a lot of misrepresentation of what the law actually says in the press over the last year or so on the subject of coordination. What the law says is that a candidate and an outside group cannot coordinate on specific ad buys. They cannot make what the law defines as a, quote, coordinated communication, close quote. But the law does not prohibit candidates from having relationships with these super PACs or other outside groups. It does not prohibit the candidates from attending, speaking, and being featured guests at the Super PAC fundraising events. In addition to the restriction on coordinating specific ad buys, there is also a prohibition on candidates soliciting unlimited money for the Super PACs. But showing up and being a featured guest at a Super PAC fundraiser has been determined by the Federal Election Commission to not be a solicitation. So what you can have here is Mitt Romney showing up at the fundraiser for the Super PAC Restore Our Future. And although Romney can only accept $2,500 contributions, the Super PAC can accept unlimited contributions from corporations and any other source. And Romney can take the microphone, talk for a half hour at the event about his campaign. None of that at an unlimited Super PAC fundraising event, and none of that qualifies under the FEC's rules as a solicitation. So there can be quite close relationships between Super PACs and candidates, despite some misconceptions out there that they have to be independent completely under the law.
Running for president is a fairly, that's an understatement, grueling process. Does this make it even more grueling that candidates now have to do those fundraising appearances double because they're meeting before these Super PACs?
I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for the candidates, and doing Super PAC, appearing at Super PAC fundraising events is entirely voluntary. It's obviously not required, and it's only going to be done by those candidates that don't have any moral qualms about evading, essentially, the $2,500 limit that applies to them by going out there and assisting, though not legally soliciting, money for these Super PACs that are going to be spending huge amounts of money. I perhaps would have more sympathy if there were some rogue Super PACs out there and we heard candidates complaining, oh, this Super PAC says it's supporting me, but I'm disavowed and I'm sorry that it's out there doing what it's doing and I wish it would stop. That's not what we're seeing. We're seeing the very close friends and career allies of candidates leaving the campaigns and setting up these Super PACs. I think the candidates are thrilled to have the ability to have these unlimited contributions raised and unlimited expenditures made by Super PACs.
What about the American people? We, as you know, in Wisconsin have all kinds of political upheaval going on now and a lot of ads for a potential recall of the governor in the state of Wisconsin. We're seeing lots and lots of ads, and instead of the normal, this was paid for by, and then the candidate speaks and you know where it's coming from. You really have no idea where it's coming from. You look at the ad and you say, oh, I wonder who put that ad together. And there might be a little thing on the bottom, but you don't know who that group is. Will that upset the American people, or do they not care what they're seeing here?
Well, I certainly think it will upset the American people. It upsets me to know that there's now record-breaking amounts of anonymous special interest money driving our election process. But the Supreme Court, five members of the Supreme Court and Citizens United, assured us that we would not be troubled by any of this. And you know, the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United is really worth a read for any of your listeners who haven't read through it. I know it's a little bit tough to get through legalese, but it's pretty striking that the court made the statements it did that, for example, that access and influence do not equal corruption, and that the American voters will not lose faith in their government even if and even though, as a result of the Citizens United decision, corporate special interests will be able to spend unlimited amounts of money to influence elections. Really bold and, I think, inaccurate representations of the sentiment of the American electorate.
We go to phone calls in just a moment. Our lines are filled. Here is our number. You'll be able to get through eventually, I hope, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the impact of the Supreme Court's Citizens United case on this year's presidential election. We've already seen an impact in Iowa, and we'll see even more as these months progress. What do you think, and what questions do you have about the intricacies of this decision? Our first guest is Paul S. Ryan. He is Program Director and Associate Legal Counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, specializing in campaign finance, ethics, and election law for more than a decade. To you, momentarily, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Going to your phone calls now, starting with Dan in Three Lakes. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. The other day when you had your open line, someone called in and promoted Lawrence Lessig's book called Republic Lost. It is precisely on this topic. I recommend that you do look into it. He makes a number of points that I'll only detail two or three. First of all, only 0.26% of the voting age population contributes $200. 0.06% of the voting age population contributes $10,000. That's hardly anybody. So damn few people are financing our elections. His proposal was for the government to rebate everybody, every voting age citizen, $50 on the condition that he send that to the candidate of his choice and file his receipt with his next income tax return. That amounts to $7.2 billion. If we can't finance every federal election that happens in this country on $7 billion, we're a bunch of morons and deserve what we get. I'll listen off the air.
And thanks for the call, Mr. Ryan.
Professor Lessig has great ideas, but in my view, they're really a recycling, to some extent a creative recycling, of ideas that have been around for over 100 years. The basic idea is public financing of election campaigns. That's what I believe that's what Larry Lessig is most adamantly advocating here, replacing the private special interest dollars with small public dollars or incentives from small donors through a government-run system that amounts to a public finance system. Great idea. The Campaign Legal Center has long supported it. There are some challenges with implementing it. And, in fact, Wisconsin had a judicial public financing program enacted, full public financing for judicial candidates, that came under legal attack immediately by the group Wisconsin Right to Life, a very active litigator opposing campaign finance laws in Wisconsin and at the federal level. And the state legislature, under that pressure of that legal attack and budgetary constraints, repealed the state's own judicial public campaign financing system in 2011, or early last year. So Professor Lessig has great ideas. Those ideas have been around for a while. They are definitely worth considering, public financing of election campaigns.
Yeah, and how long have we been talking about that?
I mean, we've had President Roosevelt was speaking about it 100 years ago.
Right.
We've had it on the books at the federal level for presidential elections since the 1970s. The first presidential election that had public funds available to candidates was in 1976, and the system was not kept up to date. It was not tuned up as an automobile built in the 70s would need to be in order to still be on the road today. And as a result, candidates aren't using it in this election cycle. Very few candidates used it in the last election cycle. But until 4 or 8 years ago, it was a very viable system that all the major presidential candidates had taken advantage of. So New York City has a great public financing program that incentivizes small donor contributions in a way similar to what Professor Lessig advocates. The city of Los Angeles, about half of the states have some form of public financing program on the books. So, again, not a new idea, but a very good idea and worth continuing to advocate and push through the state legislatures and at the federal level.
John in Beaver Dam, hi.
Hi. I'm not one usually to believe in conspiracy theories, but I see this as something like that. Back when Ronald Reagan took over, 32% of the workforce was unionized, and after 30 years of an assault on that, it's down to about 10%. So already the corporations have a huge advantage in money. Also, you've got all these states now where right-wing governors, and Wisconsin is the best example, have taken out an assault on what unions remain, and I foresee a day when there will only be corporate money. There won't be any unions to speak of whatever, and there will only be corporate money. I see this as something of a right-wing plan to have that happen.
Paul?
You know, labor unions, unfortunately, historically, have done themselves a major disservice by opposing and regularly opposing, consistently opposing meaningful campaign finance reforms until very recently. I think some unions are now seeing the writing on the wall, and they're starting to get behind some public financing proposals at the state level and federal level. But until very recently, pretty much until the Citizens United decision, labor unions were walking hand-in-hand, lockstep with corporate interests in opposing campaign finance reform. So as long as I've been doing this work, coming up on 15 years, I've always been baffled by the unwillingness of labor unions to support meaningful campaign finance reform. If it's going to be, if the question, at the end of the day, if elections are going to be decided by dollars, labor unions representing people of modest means are never going to be able to compete with corporate special interests, and it's high time that they wake up and acknowledge that and get behind meaningful campaign finance reforms.
The money that's been flowing into Iowa and that will be used by these super PACs will be primarily, and I'm wondering what percentage, for political ads, television ads?
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that it'll be primarily for TV and radio ads. This may differ a little bit from place to place depending on media markets in upcoming primaries and how they overlap with other states' media markets and how expensive they are. You could see super PACs spending money on the ground to send people door to door, spending money on direct mail pieces. Mm-hmm. But where it makes sense, presidential campaigns are largely waged through mass media buys, and I think we'll see a lot of that with super PACs.
And was this, do you imagine, just unusual in Iowa, but a lot of analysis was made of Mitt Romney's super PAC being used to run very, very negative ads against Newt Gingrich and very successfully because it brought him down. Will they be used, do you think, to bring other candidates down?
I think they will be. I think the super PACs and other outside groups, we haven't really talked yet during the program about 501c4 organizations, which are supposed to be issue advocacy groups, but if you're interested in getting into it, we could talk about how they can spend a lot of money on candidate elections. C6 groups like trade associations like the Chamber of Commerce, they're going to be in this mix too, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. All of these outside groups, all of the non-candidate, non-party groups, they're going to be the vehicles for the negative ads because they give the candidates the plausible deniability that, oh, those groups are independent, I don't want to run a negative campaign, but there's nothing I can do to stop them. When in fact, you know, the candidates have really close relationships with these people who are mounting negative campaigns. So convenient scapegoat for negative advertising. That's what these outside groups provide to candidates and parties.
Thanks, John, for the call. Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks, Kathleen, for this segue. I just don't understand the point of all the money going to advertisers and TV stations. Look, you know who I am. I've been voting for a lot of years. Give the money right to me. You know, maybe I'll go for the person who gives me the most money. Maybe I'll go for the person who gives me the last money. But I'm tired of seeing all this money flowing back and forth all for my vote. And what do I get out of it?
Well, you know, if you've been voting the same way consistently for years and years and years, then to put it bluntly, the campaigns aren't targeting you. They're really going after the undecided voters. They're early in the cycle, they're trying to ID undecided voters. They're going to take note of their already committed voters, and they're going to go back and touch base with them via campaign communications. But they're really going after the undecided voters, the swing voters that could make or break the election, not the committed, consistent, predictable voters.
Here's an email that's come in from Deb in Plymouth. I heard an idea yesterday. She thinks it's great that super PACs should be taxed at 50% and the taxes should be used to pay down the deficit. Would that be legal and doable?
You know, I would have to do a little, I would have to refresh my recollection about some other similar lawsuits. I have a vague recollection of an attempt, maybe it was in the state of Florida, to tax political committees that I believe was struck down in court on First Amendment grounds. It was a direct content-based restriction on speech, but it's worth looking into. Off the cuff, I'm thinking probably a difficult law to get passed and then to withstand a legal challenge on First Amendment grounds. I think it would be attacked as a tax on speech.
Are there challenges to Citizens United? Is there a way to challenge it?
Well, there's no way to technically, formally, legally challenge a Supreme Court decision. The way that the system works is that the state legislatures and you at the federal level, Congress, passes laws and the Supreme Court reviews them, and the Supreme Court's decision is, with respect to that exact law, it's the end of the line. It's the final decision. But there's nothing to prevent state legislatures or Congress from passing new laws that are maybe similar to the ones that one that was struck down in Citizens United, and if they have a solid legal theory about why, when that law makes it to the Supreme Court again, it would be upheld. There was a very interesting decision out of the Supreme Court of Montana last week where the state of Montana had a law very similar to the corporate spending ban that was struck down in Citizens United, but the state of Montana said, we think we're different than politics at the federal level for a variety of reasons. We think that the state of Montana had a really deep and troubling history of corruption, that its ban on corporate corporate expenditures, rather, was based upon when it was passed in about 100 years ago. So they said, we're not going to stop enforcing our law. We're going to defend it. We're going to enforce it. We're going to defend it. They were sued by a group called Western Tradition Partnership and a couple of other plaintiffs. And the state Supreme Court, five members of the state Supreme Court, upheld Montana's law in a decision last week on the basis that the U.S. Supreme Court said that the federal law was invalid because it didn't advance the government's interest in preventing corruption, but at the level of Montana, there are some historical factors that make Montana different. It will be interesting to see what happens with this Montana State Supreme Court decision. Most people observing are predicting that the Supreme Court will be appealed to the Supreme Court, that the Supreme Court will hear it, and quite possibly reverse the Montana State Supreme Court decision, which would, at the end, if that's what happens, it will bring Montana in line with the Citizens United decision and strike down the Montana state law. So there are some efforts out there to resist at the state level what the Supreme Court did in federal elections with Citizens United, but really I think that the most likely successful strategy is going to be to come up with new ways to address and prevent corruption in politics, not to simply reenact or replicate the same type of law that was struck down in Citizens United.
Tom and Stoddard, hi.
Hi. Yes, I would like to ask if this Citizens United opens the door for Rome, the Catholic Church, to make contributions to defeat a pro-abortion candidate, or for the King of Saudi Arabia to make contributions that he finds interesting to his causes, or for the Communist Party of China to dabble in our politics?
The short answer is no, not directly, and that is because for decades there's been a law, federal law in the book saying that foreign nationals cannot make contributions or expenditures in connection with federal or state or local elections, for that matter. It's one of the rare federal campaign finance laws that extends down to state and county and local races, too. But And in the Citizens United decision, the Supreme Court said explicitly that it was not ruling on or even considering or thinking about or talking about this ban on foreign national expenditures. However, it is perfectly legal for a corporation that's based here in the United States to make expenditures as a result of Citizens United, and the court gave no guidance, and the Federal Election Commission to date has given no guidance on how the decision treats a corporation that might be incorporated in Delaware, but owned in whole or in part by foreign nationals. We have no firm legal guidance. So it's possible that a foreign interest could route its own money, influence-seeking money, through a U.S.-based corporation. And the Federal Election Commission's in total gridlock and has failed to date to conduct a rulemaking to interpret or apply the Citizens United decision to that context, for wholly owned U.S.-based or wholly or partially foreign-owned U.S.-based corporations. We don't really know how they can get involved in elections to the extent to which they could roll out the scenario that you've just laid out for us.
And when you talked earlier on about money going from one place to another, to a different group, who's investigating whether or not this all meets federal law?
Well, one of the problems is that the Federal Election Commission is the federal governmental agency that's responsible for policing and enforcing campaign finance laws, federal campaign finance laws. One of the problems, though, is that it is not illegal now because of Citizens United combined with that later Speech Now decision. It is no longer illegal for a corporation to give money to a 501c4 organization, which in turn can give that money to a super PAC, and the only thing the super PAC has to report is the name of the 501c4 that it received the money from. And again, the C4 doesn't have to report the identity of its donors to anyone. So there are the problem here is what is now legal. That's a bigger problem today, I think, than the issue isn't is anyone enforcing the law or policing the law? The reality is the FEC is a very weak and gridlocked agency that, in my view, the commissioners are not doing their job adequately. But the bigger problem and the bigger scandal in 2012 is what is legal to do today.
And finally, Paul, how should things be? What's the right way to do all of these elections?
Well, that would be worth a radio show in and of itself.
Exactly.
But the earlier caller who mentioned Professor Lessig's ideas for public financing, the Campaign Legal Center has been advocating public financing for years, as long as we've been in existence. So public financing is a great start, a way to incentivize small donors and bring small donors into the system, make them the major players to de-emphasize the role of big corporate special interests. Second really important factor here is effective disclosure, getting to voters information about who is dumping money into the system to sway their vote and influence the election. Right now, there are some major loopholes and inadequacies in our disclosure laws. So doing those two things, fixing public financing, fixing disclosure, would go a long way to improving our democracy.
Thanks, Paul, very much.
Thank you.
Same topic, just switching guests. Paul S. Ryan with us, the first part of the show, the program director and associate legal counsel of the Campaign Legal Center, specializing in campaign finance ethics and election law. We are continuing. Our major question this hour is how the Citizens United has already had an impact on the caucuses in Iowa and the kind of impact that decision will have on this 2012 presidential election. Bradley Smith is joining us next. Professor Smith is a professor of law at Capital University Law School. He's one of the nation's leading authorities on election law and campaign finance. In 2000, he was nominated by President Clinton to fill a Republican-designated seat on the Federal Election Commission, where he served for 5 years, including as chair of the commission in 2004. He has also taught at George Mason University in Virginia, and he lectures widely and has been on television frequently talking about election law in this country. Our number remaining the same, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Bradley Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you.
Do you see a lot of commentators and our guest, the first part of the program, see some significant problems on Citizens United and the impact that it's having in terms of the non-effective disclosure of where this money is coming from super PACs and lack of significant regulation of making sure that we know where that money is coming from? Do you share the same concern that we don't have effective disclosure and that the races are going to change significantly and in a negative way because of the Supreme Court decision?
No, quite the opposite. I think Citizens United has been quite a success, and none of the horror stories that were predicted when it was decided have come true. Let's start with the disclosure question. Disclosure serves a couple functions. It helps voters to monitor possible sort of trade-offs that people might make, you know, give money, get some kind of reward. For that, we don't need any kind of instant disclosure. That disclosure will be there. We know who's paying for the campaigns. All of these PACs, super PACs, have to disclose all of their donors and all of their expenditures. But also, beyond that, the voters of Iowa surely know enough to vote. I mean, there's no question which candidate some of these various PACs are supporting. People understand, for example, that, I can't recall the name of it right off the top of my head, Make Us Great Again was supporting Rick Perry, or that Winning Our Future was supporting Mitt Romney. It's all over the papers. So people know when they see these ads that, yes, this is a pro-Romney group, and I think you would have figured it out anyway. So I don't see that there's a real, you know, what's the problem there? The voters have the information they need to make a formed decision about the quality of the message. And then when we look at what super PACs have done, what we've seen, first, by the way, it's worth noting that spending in Iowa this year is going to be less than it was in 2008 on the Republican side. Just on the Republican side, they're going to spend less money, so it's not really true that you're having this explosion of money being spent. But on the other hand, there's nothing terribly bad about that. I mean, we've seen in 2010, the first cycle under Citizens United, that there were more competitive races than usual. We've had, I think, over the last two or three years, actually a very good political debate in this country. I would say the most substantive debate we've had since the civil rights debates 50 years ago about sort of where is this country, where should it be going? Do we want to go toward a more of a European model, or do we want to go back toward a more slimmed-down government model? We find that the ads are, if anything, somewhat more issue-oriented. Studies consistently show that voters actually learn more about candidates from ads than they do from news coverage. So I think on the whole, Citizens United has been very successful, and I don't think most people in Iowa, you know, can sit around and think that campaigns this year are less informative or worse in some way than they were in 2008 or 2004 or 2000.
Are they more negative because the super PACs can do the dirty work?
Well, people say that. You know, how you would measure that, I don't really know. There's a couple things to note, though. First is people always complain that it's negative. I noticed, for example, there was a big editorial in the New York Times on Monday about how negative it was and due to these super PACs. What's ironic is that comes 4 years to the day after a front page headline in the New York Times about how negative the Iowa caucuses were. They have, you know, this is always said. People are always complaining that the campaigns are too negative. Negative ads, if anything, tend to help outsiders. They tend to help challengers, usually more than incumbents. You know, I think people can live with this. I mean, one of the examples the Times gave us, an example of how negative the ads were an ad, was an ad that actually said that Rick Perry was, quote, too liberal on immigration. I'm like, if we can't handle that level of negativity, whoa, you know, there's trouble, my friends, in River City. I mean, I think we can live with an ad that says Rick Perry is too liberal on immigration, or an ad, this was another one the Times cited, that said that Newt Gingrich had too much ethics baggage, or he cited another one that said that said in an obvious reference to Mitt Romney, don't let Republican establishment choose our candidate or something. I'm like, again, if that's a campaign of unprecedented ferocity, the Times terms, then I think we're in really good shape in terms of not worrying about negative campaigns.
What about the line that we've been used to hearing for years in this country? I'm candidate so-and-so, and I approve this message. Do you see a problem with candidates having messages on their behalf that maybe they don't approve?
Well, there's always an issue with that. Now, you know, I think the I'm approved this message business has been sort of ridiculous. I mean, this is something that was put into the law in 2004 for the first election cycle it was in for. It was intentionally put in there to try to reduce the number of negative messages by candidates. I think it's been shown that that didn't work. But it should also be noted that, again, challengers tend to benefit from negative ads more than incumbents. So it was viewed as a pro-incumbent measure when it was passed. I don't think many people feel that it has done much to improve campaigning. And, you know, it takes up a portion of each ad. You don't think of it as being much, but a candidate could say a lot of stuff in that time other than, you know, I'm so-and-so and I approve this message. You can say, give me liberty or give me death. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. I mean, a lot of our greatest, you know, political lines, or you could just say something like, you know, and I promise I will never raise your taxes, or whatever it is you want to say. So, again, I don't think that the fact that independent spenders don't have to include that phrase really hurts the public at all. In fact, it might enhance voter knowledge if that time in the ads is used for something more substantive.
If, though, indeed, the super PACs, as our previous guest said, spent twice as much as the candidates themselves in the Iowa caucuses, don't you run a risk of finding out who a candidate is? Shouldn't the candidate have to own his or her message and give the public a deep understanding of who they are rather than somebody else defining that for them?
Well, there's two issues here. I mean, you make a good point, but there's a couple issues. The first is that super PACs now exist because the Supreme Court has ruled that they have a constitutional right to exist, and I think that decision was correct as a matter of constitutional law. And as I've indicated here, I think it was has good benefits in policy. But the main reason, though, that they exist is that our campaign finance system has made it very hard, much harder for candidates to raise and spend money than for other folks to raise and spend money. So less and less runs to the candidate. That can be changed just by making it easier for candidates to raise money. I mean, for starters, if we just raise the amount that a candidate can except from a contributor to adjust for inflation since the amount was first put in, it would be about double what it is now, and maybe it should be considerably higher than that. So we could solve some of that problem right there. The other thing about it is that I always kind of laugh a bit sardonically when I hear people talk about this outside outside groups are defining the issues. Well, who says that campaigns are just about the candidates and what the candidates want to talk about? I mean, we're the voters, we're the people, we have a right to participate in campaigns. And you know, whether we're talking the Sierra Club or the Rifle Association or a super PAC that's formed to raise and spend money for a candidate and has to do so, by the way, independently of that candidate. It can't coordinate its message with the candidate. It can't coordinate where its ads run or what they say or anything else with the candidate. What is wrong with that? I think that's probably a healthy thing in a democracy that we're not limited to hearing only from the candidates.
Well, because the major corporations who make much more money than the Sierra Club, they have a lot more money. So it's who's got the most money?
Well, I don't think first, that's a little bit of a different question than you raised about who owns the message, so to speak. So you've got a second issue here. You're back to talking about the influence of money generally. And that's a different question. It's an important question. It's not a trivial question. But I think that we find that, generally speaking, folks are well healed all around. One of the things we see in Citizens United, again, is that if anything, it has been something of an equalizer in the money wars. That is, in 2010 at least, Republicans were more heavily supported by super PACs than were Democrats. But even so, Democrats on a whole, Democrats and their allied organizations, spent several million dollars, like almost $100 million more than Republicans did. So I think it's a mistake to think that the money is all going to flow one way or mean one thing. It will shift around in different elections. And generally speaking, it's used to finance speech, and I think it's good for voters to hear more about candidates rather than less about candidates.
Professor Bradley Smith, our guest this part of the program, professor of law at Capital University Law School, will take your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lots of interest in this topic. Our lines are filled. Keep listening. When somebody says goodbye, there may be a chance for you to say hello. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to calls. Saul in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good morning. As an individual donor, I have to give my name, address, and my occupation and some other information. What are the requirements for donors to super PACs and the groups that submit to super PACs? I'm just not clear about it.
Saul, they are exactly the same. A super PAC operates under all the same constraints as a regular PAC would, that is a PAC to which you can only give a limited amount, or that a candidate would, that is they have to ask for the name and occupation and so on of any donor over $200 to the organization. So basically they operate the same. Now there's another player potentially in elections, which are organizations, C4 organizations, such as the Sierra Club or the Rifle Association, which do not have to disclose who their donors are and can spend on political activity, although the amounts they can spend are limited to a percentage of their total activity. And those organizations do not have to disclose their donors in the same way. But part of that is because most of their donors don't give particularly for the purpose of advertising. They give to join the Sierra Club, so it's kind of tougher to say who's, you know, whether a donor is trying to pay for a particular ad or anything. But the basic rules for super PACs are the same as for any individual giving to a candidate.
So if I want to find out who the contributors to a super PAC are, I can get that information.
You can get it off the Federal Election Commission website at fec.gov. They file reports on a monthly schedule plus pre- and post-election reports just like a campaign or a regular PAC would.
And would you have any information of how many individuals are listed or whether they're primarily within other groups?
I can't tell you that at this point. You know, you can browse around the list and play around. The other one, the other place you could go, by the way, for some of this information is a group called the Center for Responsive Politics, which takes the FEC information and cuts and dices it up in a lot of different ways. And their website is opensecrets.org. It's not to be confused with the Center for Competitive Politics, which is the organization that I had, and we're at campaignfreedom.org. But in any case, those are the places where you can go and get that information. Online.
Thanks.
And you feel that information is accurate, that it's up to date, that it's true?
Yes, I think it is. Campaigns are required to ask for that information. Now, other than the name and the amount, people are not actually required to give information on their occupations, for example. But no, the basic information I think is true and correct. That's you know, obviously people could be breaking the law and submitting fraudulent reports, but that would be a violation of the law.
Thanks all for your call. Pat in Mequon. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm wondering, Dr. Smith, if you believe in campaign finance reform?
Well, I believe in it in the sense that I've seen it done. But, no, I generally do not think it's a good idea. Generally, I think that we would be better off in a system in which you had some level of disclosure for you know, high donors, but people could give and spend what they chose to give and spend.
Well, what I was thinking is that if there was a group of we, the citizens of the United States, without regard to political party, and we wanted campaign finance reform, that we could get together and insist that anyone we vote for campaign finance reform.
Because I suppose voters could, although remember that there are constitutional constraints on this. The Supreme Court has noted that the ability to spend money on campaigns, they don't say money is speech, but the ability to spend money does affect your ability to speak, one's ability to speak out and get a message out to people. So there are some constraints on that. I tend to look at it this way. Imagine if in the closing days of the Bush administration, the administration had introduced the Patriot II Act, and they said in order to limit terrorist influence on the United States, we were going to regulate how much money people could spend on political activities. And before you could do that, you would have to first register with the United States government, which would keep all this information in a database about your political activity. I think there would have been a hue and cry. People would have been, you know, an outpouring of rage about this invasion of privacy and this sort of tracking people for their political activity. But the funny thing is, we don't actually need that law. We actually have that law, and it's the Federal Election Campaign Act, which requires, as Saul just noted, that you know you have to report your contributions or they get reported by the campaigns. Anybody can look you up online and find out who you give to, who you support. You know, there are limits on how much you can spend, how much you can actively support a candidate. If a group of people wanted to get together and do what you suggested, Pat, even a small group of people there in Mequon, they would almost immediately be required to register with the government and start reporting all of their activity if they put up some yard signs or whatever. And I think people really sometimes should think a bit more seriously about that aspect of campaign finance reform.
Pat?
I think that campaign finance reform means each candidate at a certain level gets a certain amount of money to spend so that it levels the playing field so that they can't be get tremendous amounts of money contributed to their campaigns by corporations or anyone else who wants to influence them. We want to hear about the candidate.
Well, you do hear about the candidate. I mean, obviously all the spending that's been going on in Iowa is talking about the candidates. In fact, there's much more speech than if we were just talking, if we were going to limit the amounts that people could give. There's a lot more ads. People complain that there's too many ads, that there's too much about the candidates. So, you know, one thing is if you tried to equalize the money everybody had in the campaign, it's not like campaigns would be equal. Some people just have different sources of influence. If you are endorsed by the only daily newspaper in the district, that would be a big advantage. If you're well-known because you were an athletic celebrity or a Hollywood celebrity or because you were a car dealer who did your own ads and that gave you high name recognition, you'd have a big advantage over other candidates, which they might otherwise nullify with by spending more money to make themselves known. So it's not so simple. It's just sort of saying, you know, let's try to make everybody equal. I understand that impulse and that desire, but I think when you really look at it, it's a pretty tough thing to do, and we have to ask ourselves very seriously, do we want to put the government, because it's going to be government bureaucrats like the people at the Federal Election Commission, which I once headed, and they're good, well-intentioned people, but we're going to put them in charge of deciding who's spoken too much, who's spoken not enough, you know, how should we account for the fact that we're going to give each candidate the exact same amount of money, but one candidate's got all the local press behind them. You know, it's not so easy to let the government into that, and I think that's what the First Amendment was exactly intended to prevent, was the government getting into the business of trying to say, you know, who's spoken enough, who needs to speak more, what views haven't been represented enough or have been represented too much. You know, you never know. It could be your view that somebody's going to decide has been represented too much, and that's a dangerous power to give to the government.
Thanks, Pat. Time for one, maybe two calls. Bill in Madison. Hi.
I guess the the Citizens United decision that hinges around, I mean, the whole thing hinges around the idea that a corporation is the same thing for all intents and purposes as a flesh and blood human being, and which is, you know, in my opinion, you know, ridiculous on its face, because corporations do not have consciences. They do not have minds of their own in the sense that human beings do. But what about making a constitutional amendment to specifically address this, to specifically say corporations are not equivalent to human beings?
We have about 40 seconds left.
I think there's a mistake there, Bill, in the sense that Citizens United doesn't say that corporations are people. Corporations are made up of people. So you have a right to speak, and I have a right to speak, and all the other listeners have a right to speak. If we get together as one group, we still have a right to speak, and the fact that we incorporate doesn't suddenly cost us our right to speak just because we incorporate as the Sierra Club of Wisconsin or something. So it's not that corporations are people. It's that corporations are made up of people, and people have a right to speak.
Thank you so much, Professor Smith, for joining us for this very interesting hour with completely different viewpoints.
Okay,
yeah, thank you
very much, and I always thank the callers. They're always great calls when I do things on NPR.
Yeah, they are great calls. Thank you. Professor Bradley Smith, professor of law at Capital University Law School. He was nominated by President Clinton in the year 2000 to fill a Republican-designated seat on the Federal Election Commission. He served there for 5 years and was chair of the commission in the year 2004. And thanks also to our previous guest, Paul S. Ryan, FEC Program Director and Associate Legal Counsel. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting program. And thanks for all of your calls. I'm sorry if you couldn't get through. We were just swamped with calls, which is a good thing. You're actively involved. News coming up, and then we'll return.